History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time to ask some questions and, more importantly, have the patience to listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's going to be the case today in North Las Vegas, Nevada, with 99-year-old Jim Parker. He's going to turn 100 next March. And you grew up, Jim, in McAllen, Texas. Now, Texas is a big state. So tell us all where McAllen is and what that was like growing up there with a brother and four sisters.
The simplest way I have telling where it was, you take Shreveport, Louisiana, and Highway 180 came through and went through the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Mineral Wells, and then Jones County, Anson, and the county seat of Fisher County, where I was born and raised, Roby, Texas, and it comes on west of Snyder, and that highway eventually goes through El Paso and comes on out the west coast. So you take that, get to Anson, it's about 12 miles west of Anson. When Highway 180 was built in 1936, it cut the northwest corner off the farm, and the only way we had out before that was sandy, narrow lane, a half a mile to get to the next road. We were really country hicks and loved it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we got a paved highway, route to 180 right at our front door, so to speak. The farmhouse was 100 feet from the south shoulder of Highway 180 there, south of McAllen. It was a 160-acre farm, that's a half mile square, that my father's mother and dad homesteaded. Mm. And then grandfather passed away, and so my grandmother turned it over to my father. We had a fruit orchard, which was a plus, peaches, apricots, cherries, plums, and pears. We farmed with horses, so we usually had 8 or 9 horses. We had milk cows, so we usually had 8 or 10 of those. We raised pigs, so we had our pork or milk or beef, did our own butchering. It was a very educational life. At McAllen High School was probably the smallest high school ever in Texas. I graduated in 1939. May, and it was obvious there was no way to go to college. So I started battling my father, who says, well, you're not 18, you can't go anywhere yet. So I turned 18, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, reported to Kelly Field. They were asking enlisted, because they had the enlisted pilot program just begun. Did any of us want to be pilots? My buddy and I that went in with, we both did. So we both went and took the flight physicals and then the written tests for pilot training. And we got letters about 2 weeks later, as I recall, saying we'd been approved for pilot training, standby for class assignment. Buddy got in permanent party, so he was staying at Kelly Field. I was in a new organization that's being trained to go open up new fields. So I believe it's late July, they sent us to Mentor Field, Bakersfield, California. Mm-hmm. I got a picture over there to show you barracks before they had streets, dust 6 inches deep. But after I got through with all the pilot tests and everything, then came KP. So I'm standing there in the kitchen and washing those big old aluminum pots they cook potatoes in. That sergeant come around and said, you don't look too happy. I said, how in the hell can I be? I came in to fight a war and you got me washing pots. He laughed at me and he turned around and he says, you're serious. He says, what else can you do? And so he took me in to the back part of the kitchen, and they just brought a half of beef in. That's the way they delivered to the military in those days. He says, you know anything about how to cut up a beef? I said, you got about 10 sharp knives and somebody to keep them sharp for me? Yeah, what are you going to do? I said, is that table available? So I had them take it off the hook and lay it on the table. 35 minutes later, it was all cut up and stacked and roasting steaks and ribs and what have you. And I said, this you can grind up and make chili out of. Where in the hell did you learn all of that? I said, from birth. Anyway, they gave me a PFC, my fifth day in there, because of my ability with cutting up a beef, I guess, was the real story.
Who knew when that was going to come in handy? And that makes me wonder. We'll get back to where you are there. But growing up on that farm, I'm sure there are a lot of chores or duties that you had that most kids don't encounter today.
Yeah, we get the seniority down for, I was the fifth of six children. I had one sister that was younger than myself. And initially, I was assigned to my mother to gather the eggs, to build a fire in the oven and a stove cook. We had wooden cook stove. She was using the boiling pot. I had to build a fire under it and get that thing on and keep it just the way she wanted it. And I developed a knack of finding woods for the kitchen stove, cooking stove, that would ignite quickly and were hot. You know, we're ready to give you the heat. Then, of course, the other duties were to help with milking the cows, slopping the hogs, feeding the cows, feeding the horses, being sure they got the water. That was a very dry area in there. We had a well about 200 feet north of our property and the neighbor's property, but he titled that well to my father. We had a cistern where you bring the water off the roof during rain showers into the cistern, but it was dry most of the time. So we used that well water for all animals and family. We usually milk five or six cows every morning, every night. This has to be done at a certain time before daylight and after dark, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Except you don't milk at night, so we had to get in just before dark on the evening. At 5 years old, I could harness up a team of horses.
5 years
myself,
old?
Myself.
Wow.
Hitch them to a plow, a cultivator, a planter, or a wagon, and go do whatever was to be done with that equipment. And my dad thought he was good with animals, but I had the animals on my side. They knew I liked them, so they were always, my brother and father would walk into the lot in the morning to hitch up three teams. Here come all the horses to me. And I'd chide him. I'd say, well, I'll tell my brother to be good to you today. I'll tell my dad to be good to you. And horses, when they're playing with you, they have to get behind your back while you're talking and then give you a big push with their nose. You can talk about poverty and hardship, but if you take all the surroundings, it probably was the most phenomenal way to grow up that there was on a farm.
Well, and I'm wondering if the horses liked you because they thought you were one of them. I heard you slept in the barn for a while.
Oh, I did. My mother didn't like boys. She had four girls and two boys. My brother and I rarely slept in the house more than three nights a year. That didn't bother either of us. Fresh air was good for us. In good weather, we'd sleep under a tree. Bad weather, we'd get in a storm cellar or go to the barn. Yeah, they thought we were part of them because my brother and I, we were sleeping in the barn more than we were in the house. And animals are a lot smarter than you give them credit for. I don't know where I'd what you'd call it, soft hands or what, but the old cows, my dad and I walked into the milk lot at the same time, they all came to me. I talked to the animals and they talked to me. He's asked me quite a few times, well, how did you know how to learn this? I said, everything I know was taught to me by a horse. They are work animals, and they know it, and they know how to react to treatment. It's an education just watching an animal for 5 or 10 years.
Hey, what about the Great Depression? Because so many people I've talked to who lived through that, and you were a child when the Great Depression hit.
Right.
Did having the farm insulate you from some of the effects of that?
Well, to be honest with you, in my analysis, it totally... I didn't feel anything. Everything was the same. We worked with the animals. Of course, we had fruit, which most people didn't have an orchard around. And we butchered calves and we butchered dogs. And I had a pretty easy life as far as food goes. I don't know what a box house is, but you build a base, a 2x6 base, and put flooring on it. And you take 1x12s, start them at the corners, and then you run a 2x6 deal around the top of that. But the house is just that 1x12 board between you and the outside. And then they put a 1x4 ship lamp over the cracks in the 2x12s. You had pretty cool winters there in that area. We have snow about every fourth or fifth year. Survival was to be ready for whatever was going to happen before it happened. My mother didn't let the girls get out and do farm work. She didn't mind sending me as 3 or 4 years old out to milk the cows, but the girls won't have to do that. I probably have more education from natural sources than did from school, because Macaulay was, put it this way, the last on the educational requirements of the state of Texas. Kind of drew a picture to me that there's no wall too high to climb, too rough to succeed. And I told my dad I wanted to go in the military. He was of the opinion that all they were in the military were dope addicts and drunks. I didn't believe him then, and when I went in the service, I found out that that was less than 1% of the military. But as I told him, I said, at least they've got different fields of work so I can learn how to do something.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, when you enlisted and then you signed up for the opportunity to be a pilot, that that was a goal of yours.
Yeah.
How early did that thought arrive in your mind that maybe someday you'd like to fly?
I started at about 6 years old, and for a couple of years there, and don't ask me why, then the fever went down. I had too much work to do, I guess, and which was good. As soon as I graduated from high school, well, as soon as I turned 18, then I was the boss, not my dad. He was a gentleman, but he had a lot of things to learn, like all of us do, particularly in family life. But when I got to the Army, I looked at the guy wearing a star on his shirt. He learned how to get things done, or he wouldn't be wearing that star. So I don't worry about what I don't know. I worry about what I'm learning and how to use what I'm learning.
Mm-hmm.
But that kitchen, it took me less than a day to show them everything I knew about cooking. And they taped it, and they taught it to the newcomers as they come along. But that's neither here nor there.
Before you go any further, I'm curious, is there something you look back on from your childhood or something that, you know, before you joined the Army that was a spark that was lit for your desire to fly? Was there something that turned you on to that idea of maybe flying someday?
I never saw an airplane. We didn't have magazines or newspapers. It was just looking back on it now, I think that God just set me up. That's what I wanted to do. Of course, I didn't listen to him. I only did it for 50 years.
I'm sure there's more to that story. So you show them what you can do butchering that side of beef. They put you to work there in the kitchen.
I got out of the kitchen there and worked in a radio shop, changing out radios, and then they put me in the control tower. When I got to Metro, the control tower was full. And that's where I went to the fire department initially. And then when that fire department horror story was over, they sent me out to the flight line. This is my schedule. Monday morning, I report flight line to staff sergeant that was flight chief. He assigned me as the third man on an aircraft maintenance. Now, this single-engine pilot trainer, the Vultee BT-13. Anyway, the first day, I was third man on the crew. I went to work Tuesday. I was second man on that crew. I go to work Wednesday, and here's a sergeant stopping me on the way in, and he says, "Hold it." And he introduced me to two corporals. He says, "These two guys just finished the Army Air Corps aircraft maintenance course at Chanute Field, Illinois, and they're going to be your assistants." And he takes me over, and he shows us the airplane we're going to maintain. So that's my third day on the flight line. I'm a crew chief with two assistants that outranked me. I thought, well, that's all going to happen this week. So go in Thursday morning. Here came the sergeant flight chief. "Since you got these two guys been through school, I'm going to give you two airplanes to crew." Friday, so I'm about that time I met Joyce and stuff.
Yeah, tell me about that. So it's a really good thing that you got sent to Minter Field, because there was someone very special for you to meet there. And if you hadn't met Joyce and the three children and four grandkids and seven great-grands and two great-great-grandchildren, wouldn't be here. So how did you meet Joyce?
I always kept a buddy in the chaplain's office. So he called me one day and he said, "Chaplain, it's arranged an off-base party He told me to ask you to get as many of your buddies as you could to go, because he promised me to have a bunch of young GIs over there at the party. So it was in a farm home right at the edge of Shafter. It really wasn't out in the country. Huge house. The living room was as big as this whole house, I think. It was the senior girls' class that was throwing the party. Joyce was president of the home ec club. So I'm there, and these kids and girls coming around, and they're talking and yakking, sound like my sisters. And all of a sudden, I thought, that's my buddy. I said, if I had my eyes closed? And he said, no. I said, well, that girl wasn't sitting over there on that couch the last time I looked. Well, later on, I finally analyzed that she was in there helping her buddy's mother with getting the goodies that they were going to feed us that night together, being she was president of the home ec club. So I jump up, shoot myself here, and I go over and introduce myself to her. She wasn't impressed. But she was a very honest, direct person. She wouldn't lead you along for anything. Before I got up to walk over to introduce myself to her, I knew right then that that was the female I wanted to marry. And I hadn't even thought about marriage before I saw her.
How in the world could you possibly know that? You hadn't even talked to her
know.
Yet.
I've had those hunches through life, and I played them out. They've always been the best way to go. We visited, started feeding us, so we were eating. I asked, could I take her home after the party? She was a little slow. Finally says, okay, I guess that'll be all right. I know now that then she was running everything she had on me through the lines to be sure that there weren't going to be any mistakes made. The party ended, and I had a little 36 Ford coupe with a rumble seat. One of my buddies had gotten a date with the daughter of the family we had the party, Alberta McKinley. I said, well, Joyce, you and I are riding a rumble seat. Benny and Drive, she didn't want a rumble seat, but we got up in front of her house, and they had a fenced front yard. Helped her out of the rumble seat and over to the gate, asked her to get her phone number to call her for a date. That was it. Next morning, a couple of my buddies and I were in town playing the pinball machines, was the thing that we did then in spare time. And this man walked up to me and said, are you dating my daughter? I'd never seen the guy before in my life. He was exactly the same height as me. And it turned out, as we married, he's the same weight. I said, who's your daughter? And he said, Joyce Townsend. I said, I'm guilty. He says, okay, from now on, I don't want to see you around my house. We were standing there face to face, nose to nose. I said, sir, I want to tell you something. You got it all wrong. I've already fallen in love with your daughter, so nothing's going to change that, particularly you. If she accepts, I'm going to date her. So I'm going to show up there. What are you going to do about it?
Wow.
It's amazing. The rest of my life, we married, and he and I really struggled at first. He thought he could run over me, and he found out running over me was like having a major wreck. All of a sudden, he was my buddy.
It's time for our first break. I sure hope you're enjoying this spirited storyteller as much as I am. You can check out photos and a short video with 99-year-old Jim Parker at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.